They sneak across the border by the millions to work in our fields. Thus, you and I can eat cheap food. This way of doing business has worked so well, agriculture must now have illegal immigrants just to survive. This reliance on a never-ending stream of cheap labor leads us to ask, can we eat without illegal immigrants?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 686th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Montevideo who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
And producers Carol Stafford and Kelsey Olson have the day off. And folks, it is this from a Wisconsin dairy farmer with 150 cows. So as our last two children entered high school, I realized that soon I would have no family labor to rely on, so we moved to all hired labor. I have not been able to hire an American citizen since 1997. I have tried. The way I see it, if we don't have Hispanics to rely on for a workforce, I don't believe I could continue farming. Our children have left the farm for the city, and now we must rely on the hands of immigrants to provide us with food. It is estimated that 75% of this immigrant labor force is illegal or undocumented, as some would have us say. As legal citizens, the children of illegal immigrants also leave the farm for the city, and thus a never-ending vacuum of need is created within agriculture that encourages more immigrants to illegally cross the border. Agriculture's never-ending need for cheap labor leads us to ask, can we eat without illegal immigrants? Here to help us find an answer, we have Craig Regelbrugge, who is co-chair of Agriculture Coalition for Immigration Reform. Craig, welcome to the Food Chain.
Michael, it's good to be with you.
So you're a veteran of the horticulture industry, right?
That is correct.
Which means what to the people out there?
Well, the industry that I've worked with for about 20 years is the nursery and landscape industry. So on the production side, the farming side, we're growing all the things that you see in your landscape. We're also growing the trees, the vines, the plants that end up in the food production system, you know, tree fruits, apples, pears, you know, all that. And so those are the things that my industry produces.
Okay. Let's see. There we have a little adjustment. Good. And so that's a pretty labor-intensive business when it gets right down to it, too, isn't it?
It is.
You need people to move the pots from one place on one side of the greenhouse to the other.
You need people. You need hand labor throughout the production system from the time you start a plant, whether it's from a seed or whether it's from a cutting, until the time it reaches the ultimate consumer.
Mm-hmm. And it really is a nursery.
Absolutely.
So in the sense of a nursery of the hospital where they take care of children, it's a hand-intensive operation, and that's the way of it. So what is the Agriculture Coalition for Immigration Reform?
This is a coalition that was formed in about 2001 as an ad hoc. You know, it's not meant to be permanent. It's a coalition made up of over 300 organizations, national, regional, state, and in a few cases, local, whose members are engaged in labor-intensive ag. Basically, it's all the things we produce in this country that you cannot produce without some hand labor. You've got hand labor tasks throughout the production. So we're talking about fruits, vegetables, nursery and greenhouse crops, Christmas trees, animal agriculture, especially dairy, but also livestock and ranching. And so the coalition is made up of employer groups who, frankly, have been trying to get beyond the situation you described in your intro.
Right, exactly. And it started in 2001?
That's correct.
Well, you're well on your way to being there forever, I guess.
I hope not. I'd love to move on to other issues, frankly.
Okay, so let's start this off by talking about to what extent agriculture has come to rely on illegal immigration. In looking at the material you have posted on the internet, I was quite flabbergasted by the notion that up to 75% of those working out there in the fields or in the factories of our food system are not supposed to be there.
Yeah, let me take you on a quick timeline. If you go back to the World War II era, I think it is safe to say that our agricultural production system in this country has been pretty heavily reliant on foreign-born labor since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
In the World War II and Korean War era, there was a legal program, and I can go into more detail about what that
would
actually
be. The Bracero program.
Exactly.
Which literally translates to a strong arm, right?
Yeah, and, you know, our able-bodied men were off fighting foreign wars,
right.
And we admitted at the Bracero program's peak something on the order of 400,000 workers on a seasonal basis who came, worked, and left. Bracero is... just the word itself conjures up controversy because to many the program lacked labor protections that we now take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And, it wasn't a perfect thing, but it did provide a legal mechanism is the key point.
So we had a legal mechanism, and so we kind of came to rely on the immigrants to a certain extent right after World War II or during World War II because all the boys were off fighting in the war, so we had to have somebody there to grow the food.
Yeah, and as you move forward over time, the somebody, the foreign-born workers and their indispensable nature in the workforce really never changed. Now, why is that? Over all these decades, since the World War II Korean War era, you know, our society has fundamentally changed. It has become more urban, more
mm-hmm.
suburban. It has become, quite frankly, grayer.
Mm-hmm.
We have now achieved the highest educational level in our nation's history.
We're very smart, and we live in the city, and we don't want to work on farms.
And that's, you know, around, and that's the master narrative. I mean, there are exceptions. There are still farm families who have some kids that decide to stay
mm-hmm.
in the business. But
in with respect to the big agriculture, it has become industrialized, and to the extent that families participate, they kind of participate on a different level, don't they?
Well, I think some aspects of ag have become pretty industrialized, but as a practical matter, in many or most of these industries, you're still talking about family-based owners.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, you're talking about larger farms. In some cases, not. But you started out with the Wisconsin dairy story.
Yeah, let's go there.
A 150-cow dairy is a relatively small dairy. And in fact,
but it's a relatively big dairy, from what I have seen, with respect to family scale operations. I mean, 150 milking. I milked cows before. Milking 150 cows that's industrial work right there.
Well, the entire industry has shifted. Producers have gotten larger in order to survive.
Right.
As margins have decreased, and. So in that whole dynamic, people have attempted, there's been major mechanization in the dairy industry. But as a practical matter, I mean, I've studied the Wisconsin situation pretty closely, and Wisconsin is referred to as America's Dairyland. California is actually number one in the nation.
Right, right.
But in the Wisconsin dairy industry, foreign-born labor, probably improperly documented, falsely documented, is nearing 50%. Of the hired labor force.
What was the 75% figure I saw in your...
That we believe that's a national figure,
mm-hmm.
and for reasons that we'll get into during this hour, I'm sure, we believe that there is a higher percentage of crop workers without proper immigration status, because crop work tends to be, in some respects, the worst. It's very arduous. In some cases, it's migrant, although migrancy is not the rule, but it is. Inherently seasonal. You pick the peaches when the peaches are there. You pick the apples when the apples are there. So it's more challenging for somebody who is seeking the most stable employment they can find. You know, they have to piece together a lot of different jobs to make a living.
And so you got to keep moving on. You know,
the more stable jobs in animal agriculture, in some degree in my industry and whatnot, you're going to have a marginally lower percentage of those jobs taken, that end up being filled by workers whose immigration status isn't so good.
Okay, good. There were some very interesting statistics that I noticed in your presentation. One of them was that it seemed to be that the bigger the farm, the greater the percentage of illegal immigrants.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true. I think it probably varies sector to sector. But looking at the Wisconsin thing, for example, the Wisconsin situation in dairy specifically, and this was studied at length by a sociologist at the University of Wisconsin, if you look at just the overall number of foreign-born and believed unauthorized is probably the proper term because they're technically unauthorized from a work eligibility standpoint.
Can you hold this, Craig? We have to take a quick break, and this is such an important figure that I'd like to come back to.
Sure, I'll hold that.
Folks, this is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. Today we're talking about immigration reform. It's the second in our series, probably about the 900th in our series when it gets right down to it. But second in that we've done recently, we were talking with Craig Regelbrugge, who is co-chair, Agriculture Coalition for Immigration Reform. And, of course, we're talking to you. Do you think we can now eat without illegal immigrants? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
President Barack Obama says that state and local governments should have some say over gun control and that he believes in a common sense approach to gun control. However, translate the president's intentions, one thing is certain, it's going to cost a whole lot more to buy guns and ammo in the future. So before that future arrives, head to the giant TS Gun Show at the Santa Clara County Fairgrounds on Tully Road in San Jose this weekend. You'll find everything under the sun for the hunter, sportsman, and collector, including guns, knives, antiques, military goods, sporting goods, books, coins, ammo, jewelry, cases, safes, and accessories. Go early to the Giant TS Gun Show for the best deals this Saturday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Sunday from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Admission is just $8 per person, and children 12 and under get in free when accompanied by a parent or legal guardian. All local, state, and federal laws will be followed. It's going to cost a whole lot more to own handguns, rifles, and shotguns in the future, and the future is coming fast. So head to the Giant TS Gun Show this Saturday and Sunday at the Santa Clara County Fairgrounds and save big.
To what extent has our agriculture come to rely on the labor of illegal immigrants? Well, if you're talking about a Wisconsin dairy farmer, it would seem to be a lot. And to learn how much, let's talk with Craig Regelbrugge, who is with the Agriculture Coalition for Immigration Reform. There was a couple of your graphs with respect to the immigration situation in Wisconsin dairy farms that kind of caught my attention, Craig. One was the number of undocumented or illegal workers and the size of the farms. It seemed to me that the larger the farm got, the more it relied on illegal immigrants. Did I see something that I didn't see there?
Well, it's been about a year since I've studied. I was up in Wisconsin working with the industry up there. But my recollection is that, I mean, of course, as dairies get larger, they hire more labor.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, what I saw in the charts and graphs out of University of Wisconsin is that there are actually more foreign-born workers employed in small dairies, net total, more employed in small dairies than in large dairies. Just because in Wisconsin, the structure of that industry, there are so many small dairies, and most of them have a couple of hired workers, and frankly, most of them are foreign-born.
And the other statistic that caught my attention was the shift work. Depending on what shift we're looking at, the first shift, which I assume would be the 8-to-5ers, largely that shift was made up mostly of the owners and American-born citizens, with a fair percentage of undocumented workers in there as well. But as you go into the swing shift and the late shift and the midnight shift and whatnot, they seem to be almost all undocumented workers.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and I think it speaks to the question of cause and effect. There are people out there who will argue that these workers are stealing American jobs, and the statistic you just read demonstrates the reverse. Jobs that are going begging are drawing workers, and so you see the foreign-born workers in the Wisconsin dairy industry mostly working the least attractive jobs. They're working the night shift, when you know, an American who's willing to do dairy work is going to choose the day shift.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that those studies found that I thought was kind of fascinating is, you know, contrary to the perception that the foreign-born workers would be hired so that they could be paid less, overall compensation was about equivalent. Now, sometimes actual, you know, salary was slightly lower, but it's because the foreign-born workers were provided other benefits that the U.S. workers didn't require, such as on-farm housing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's fair enough. To what extent do the conditions in the Wisconsin dairy industry reflect the industry of agriculture throughout the United States? Is it similar?
Very, very similar. I mean, this phenomenon, and you know, hopefully a little bit later in the program we can go into where did we go wrong, if you will.
That's the next question.
Yeah, how can we get back on track? But this phenomenon is absolutely coast to coast, border to border.
Mm-hmm.
The demographics of Senator Olympia Snowe and Senator Susan Collins' agricultural labor force in Maine are no different than the demographics of Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer's agricultural labor force. The size is different because, you know,
sure,
California ag is king in this nation, and it's virtually, you know, nearly everything you do out there is by definition very labor intensive. But the problem is the same border to border, coast to coast, and that, you know, that has enormous implications for how we get to solutions.
All right, good. Well, how on earth did we come to this point where we essentially can't eat without illegal immigrants? What where did we go wrong? What happened?
Yeah. Well, I think if you look at, I mean, I already spoke to the demographic shift in our society because
mm-hmm.
I think it's important for people who think that there are American workers who are going to revert to a lifestyle that they left decades or even generations ago. That's not realistic. I mean, the foreign-born workers have been doing this since World War II. But I think, you know, I mentioned that in the World War II Korean War era, we had a legal channel program, again, discredited relative to labor abuses, but it was a legal channel program, and it functioned.
Called the Bracero program.
They called the Bracero program, and it actually had an enormous impact on curbing illegal immigration, underscoring the role of legal channels.
And was it relatively easy to work? I mean,
yeah.
for the farmers, did they have to go through, you know, 6 months worth of paperwork, you know, to get?
No, I mean, my perception, I wasn't, frankly, living during those times,
right,
but
right.
I've done a fair amount of reading, and my perception is that the program, you know, from a user-friendliness standpoint, was pretty open. You know, farm worker advocates are concerned about the abuses, and in some cases, you know, the Mexican government held people's money, and the argument is that it was never returned to them, and so forth. But it was a pretty functional program since that time.
Okay, so let me ask you this. The immigration reform show number one, a few weeks ago, I featured Deborah Notkin, who's with the past president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association.
Mm-hmm.
And when I brought up the Bracero program, I thought she was going to have a heart attack. because
the good news is we can learn from the Bracero program without repeating it.
But why was she so – I tried to ask her, and it was just like she was insulted that I would ask.
Yeah. I believe that for many whose focus is workers' rights, the Bracero program, they see it, you know, and I'm not going to argue for or against. Like I said, I wasn't alive at the time, but they see it as rife with abuse, as having been rife with labor abuse and exploitation. I think the way to look at Bracero – in the context of the debate we're having today about illegal immigration, is what impact did the program have on illegal immigration? And the interesting thing, just very briefly, the INS commissioner at the time was trying to crack down on illegal immigration, and he knew that legal channels were a key element of the solution. So they essentially made the Bracero program available to growers, and by the time the program peaked in the early 1950s, illegal immigration declined by 95%. And in 1963, under organized labor pressure, the program was terminated in the Kennedy administration. And over the next 12 years, illegal immigration rose 1,000-fold. So I don't think we look to Bracero as a model for labor protections. I think we look to the Bracero program just for the lesson of what role do legal channels play in resolving
the problem. It was organized labor that got rid of the Bracero program.
That's my understanding, yeah, 1963. I was born in 64, so again, I didn't have a front row seat.
Well, let me ask you, this from Cesar Chavez, who is the founder, of course. Oh, I can't do this. It's just not enough time. But when we come back, we're going to address it. And let's go quickly to Wendy, who has a comment or a question. Wendy, welcome to the Food Chain.
Oh, thank you. I was wondering if you could clarify the dynamic of the Wisconsin illegal labor versus in California. In California, it's almost synonymous with Mexico or Latin America.
And actually, in Wisconsin, my understanding is it's quite similar. The phenomenon that's happened, and this is a complicated issue, and it would be easily misunderstood what I'm about to say, but you know, as we have invested billions and billions and billions more on border infrastructure and border patrol and so forth, those efforts, you know, while well-intended, and I think most of us would support them, they've had the unintended consequence of cutting off the phenomenon known as circularity, where people would come, they'd work the season, and then they'd go home. And so what's happened essentially is circularity has been stopped because it's gotten too dangerous and too expensive to come and go, which has caused people to look to settle. And so, you know, the phenomenon in Wisconsin is really not much different. You know, by word of mouth, people have learned there's a job available in a dairy or whatever, and the sending regions may differ slightly, but most of the farm labor throughout the country is of Mexican origin and to some degree Central American.
That's interesting. I wanted to make sure of that. The middlemen, do you have a lot of people going to an employment agent and basically getting illegal labor without even knowing it?
That's a very good question, Wendy. The use of farm labor contractors has become very prevalent in a couple parts of the country, and it's happened for a variety of reasons, and not solely as a means of not having to worry quite as much about who you're hiring. In my industry, for example, people would much rather hire labor directly than to work through a labor contractor. But
that's the way it is. We're going to take a quick break. Wendy,
okay.
You want to hang or are you done?
I'm done. Okay,
thank you very much. Folks,
bye.
This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Craig Regelbrugger, who is the co-chair of Agriculture Coalition for Immigration Reform, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back with Cesar Chavez and the UFW. Well, they sneak across the border by the millions to work in our fields. Thus, you and I can eat cheap food. This way of doing business has worked so well, agriculture must now have illegal immigrants just to survive. This reliance on a never-ending stream of cheap labor leads us to ask, can we eat without illegal immigrants? And that is the question that really struck me when I considered doing this program. And was looking at the material provided by Craig Regelbrugger of the Agriculture Coalition for Immigration Reform, and just realizing the extent to which our food is dependent on illegal or undocumented immigrants. Truly staggering, up to 75% of what we eat is made possible by the hands of those illegal immigrants. And so we're looking at this situation thinking, what can be done? And why did it come to this incredible extent that we're facing today? So in the 60s, I guess you said, Craig, the labor unions organized themselves and went to Washington, D.C., and got rid of the Bracero program, which was an organized program to bring laborers into the United States and have them do the work in the fields. So I guess that the labor unions were figuring that if they got rid of the foreign laborers, then they would be able to organize the farm labor and have lots of new members and make lots of more money. I guess something like that, right? Oops, let me press your button here. There you go.
Was at the time.
So this from Cesar Chavez in 1979 in testifying to Congress. When the farm workers strike and their strike is successful, the employers go to Mexico and have unlimited, unrestricted use of illegal alien strike breakers to break the strike. And for over 30 years, the Immigration and Naturalization Service has looked the other way and assisted in the strike breaking. I do not remember one single instance in 30 years where the Immigration Service has removed strike breakers. The employers use professional smugglers to recruit, and that's pretty much the way it is today, isn't it?
Well, no. The way it is today in the hiring process is that employers are typically hiring every warm body that crosses the threshold of the office and applies for the job.
You need the word.
And in that context, employers are walking a line, and this goes back to the law that passed in 1986, which is a key consideration in why the world looks the way it does now. But employers have to look at certain approved forms of documentation to verify work eligibility. If they get too picky about documents, if they don't treat everybody equally, if they demand other documents, if the documents look genuine and the employer gets too picky, they run the risk of ending up in court over discrimination claims. So it's kind of a catch-22. But at the end of the day, the reality that's facing the sector is that the vast majority of people who are showing up are of dubious immigration status.
So there we are, and it hasn't changed for many, many years, and we're stuck with this situation where we're essentially, am I wrong in thinking that the children, the legal children of illegal immigrants, the immigrants that's snuck across the border and stayed here and had children, that those children are not too hot on the idea of working in the fields either, are they?
I suspect that's true. I don't know the numbers, but I suspect a lot of children of farm workers move on to other things.
Mm-hmm.
I could name numerous examples of people that I've known working in politics who have been very highly accomplished people,
sure,
whose parents were farm workers. But the rest of the story...
Me for one.
Well, yeah, but I think the rest of the story is this question of who will... Assuming we're farming here tomorrow...
Yeah, so assuming we want to eat...
If we're eating and if we're producing what we're eating in this country, who will be the farmers of the future? And we've already seen a pattern,
right,
where many of the mid-level supervisors and in some cases even farm managers are Hispanic, and many of them, probably, truth be known, their papers aren't so good. I believe that some of the people that are resident in the current farm worker population are going to go on to scrimp and save and ultimately buy out the retiring American farmer. Many of these people will be the farmers of tomorrow if we arrive at a rational conclusion and a rational solution to the challenge we're facing.
Mm-hmm. And the odds of that are, we'll pick that up in a moment, but the reason I asked about the children of immigrant farm workers was that if they don't go back and replace their parents in the field, then we have this situation that creates kind of a vacuum that brings in more illegal immigrants, and thus we're just flooded with illegal immigrants.
Well, and part of what you just described is a result of what we did in 1986.
Which was
the Immigration Reform and Control Act, signed into law by Ronald Reagan. And what it did in the agricultural setting was a one-time legalization. It was a true amnesty, if you look up how Webster,
sure,
defines amnesty. And, essentially what happened is over time, many of those workers left agriculture for better opportunities. The jobs in agriculture are entry-level, they're intermittent, they're seasonal.
Now that I'm legal, I don't have to do that job anymore.
Yeah, and so, and, you know, people in a growing economy who could move on many times did.
Mm-hmm.
But what IRCA, what the legislation back then utterly failed to do is to consider future needs in our economy. That was left off the table, completely left off the table. And so part of the reason we're back here, there really are two reasons. One is that we left the question of legal channels for the future aside. And the second one is that the employer sanctions of IRCA, you know, the let's punish the employer,
sure,
and hold them accountable, it was a paper-based system that in the real world failed. So the enforcement side failed and the legal channels were ignored, and that's fundamentally why we're here.
And so we're right back to the same situation we were in 1986 then.
Yes, with I think some opportunity if everybody would take a deep breath and if we could have a civil discourse rather than a screaming match. I think we have the ability to get it right this time.
Why is it a screaming match? Why can't we approach this with some kind of logical, dispassionate reasoning?
Well, I think that's your program is a key element. It's okay, folks. There's a lot of passion out there. There are very strong feelings, but let's get armed with the facts and let's have a rational discourse. And I think, at the end of the day, you've got probably 20% of the population that doesn't care what the facts are, and they're angry. They're angry about a lot of things, and they're not going to go along for the ride. Any proposal that is put out there. That has a realistic chance of attracting the support and actually solving the problem. They throw labels on it, seven-letter bumper stickers like amnesty, end of discussion. But, the polling, and I've looked at tons of polling over a long period of time, the polling on this issue is very consistent. There is a broad majority, usually approaching 80%, that want a solution, want our political leaders to deliver one. They want a sense of fair play.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know that people are paying their fair share. They want to know that that those who committed a transgression of coming here without permission have to somehow make it right, that they don't get a free pass, but that there's some atonement. They're open to redemption, but they want there to be atonement.
Folks, this is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour. We're talking about immigration, part two of a 300-part series that we've been doing over the years. This is a 686 show, and I think we've talked about this issue about 50 times over the course of the years. And it just doesn't seem to get better. What will it take to make it better, to make things work on a rational basis instead of the pandemonium that we have today? What do you think? Can we eat without the hands of illegal immigrants? 800-624-2665, 831-4798. Right back with Ag Jobs. Well, in my musing about immigrant labor and agriculture, I came up with a what if. But before we get to my what if, let's go to the what if of Craig Regelsbrugge and the Coalition, Agriculture Coalition for Immigration Reform. You folks have certainly been faced with this incredible situation for decades now, and you have an idea on how to fix it. What is that idea, Craig?
Yeah, and I think, first of all, I'd like to state if agriculture liked the way it is, we wouldn't be out on the playing field trying to resolve it.
Right.
And we have been for a long time now. And back in the 90s, I'll make this part quick, but back in the 90s, there was an effort by agricultural employers to simply fix the existing, there is an existing but very seldom used guest worker program known as H-2A. And when we attempted to fix that program, but the solution was seen as one-sided. It was seen as the employers getting it their way, and the advocates for workers and worker rights didn't much appreciate that. And so we were at war for a period of years, and ultimately, in about the year 2000, both sides realized that the only way we're going to get something done is to find middle ground and to be a little bit practical and willing to compromise, and so we did that. It took years to get there, but we ultimately coalesced around a piece of legislation known as the Agricultural Job Opportunity Benefits and Security Act, or Ag Jobs. And Ag Jobs is about more than just farm jobs. It's about U.S. jobs, too, which I can explain later. But essentially, the approach that we take in Ag Jobs is a long-term approach and a bridge to that future. The long-term approach is improving the H-2A program, where we think it will be a more reliable legal labor safety net and more usable by farmers.
So is this kind of an update of the Bracero program?
Well, it's quite a bit different. I mean,
nobody wants to use the
layers of protections. I mean, if you look at the United Farm Workers and Cesar Chavez's union, for example, I mean, they bitterly opposed the Bracero program.
Right.
But they have been more pragmatic about retooling H-2A where it will work so long as workers have adequate enforcement rights and protections.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, we had to thread seven needles and find the way to meet employers' fundamental needs but not sacrifice workers.
So who's against this?
Well,
why isn't it law?
I mentioned the long term being H-2A, and the bridge to the long term is what do you do about the experienced farm workers who are here? And in the case of Ag Jobs, we took the position that allowing people who are otherwise law abiding to earn legal status over time, if they're willing to jump through a lot of hoops, is the right way to address the problem. We don't guarantee citizenship or something, but, you know, as a practical matter, we provide a path whereby people can earn their way, make it right, and so forth. And, you know, in the current debate,
how does this resolve the situation where that we ran into in 1986, where we had amnesty, okay, all the oxen free, everybody's free, and then here we are again?
Well, two ways. The transition strategy is that one of the conditions people need to meet to make it right is to make a multi-year commitment to continue to perform agricultural work. Now, they're not tied to an employer. That would be called indentured servitude. They're allowed to move among jobs and seek the best opportunities, you know, but they have to complete so many days of agricultural work per year over a period of 5 years. And what that essentially does is it settles what is for a period of time so we can transition to wider reliance over time on a legal channel program that allows people to come and work the season and go home with adequate labor protections.
Hmm.
I think the other thing that's different in this debate, you know, the IRCA tried to hold employers accountable for who they've hired. That's the 1986 legislation.
Which it never worked.
It never worked. It was a paper-based system, and it ended up being full of loopholes, and it didn't work. And I think that's a lot of the reason why Americans are frustrated. They want to know a system works. I think we're at a point where electronic eligibility verification, where you have to swipe a card that searches against the databases or, you know, something like that, is an inescapable reality. It's going to become, if there is reform, I think that there is the opportunity now. Technology's advanced, the need is seen as great, and I think we have the ability for enforcement to have integrity so that people who want to be within the law have the tools, and people who want to skirt the law are more exposed and more easily, frankly, caught.
Mm-hmm. So then, who's against this?
Well, you know, not very many folks are against it. I think.
Then why isn't it law?
That's a very good question, and I think you know, one way I could answer it is to say that we have been the victims of both political parties in Washington. I think the fundamental problem is that, you know, petty politics and point scoring have taken precedence. And so, you know, there have been times over the last 10-year period where we've been held hostage by one party or the other. There are times that we've been held hostage for a comprehensive debate. You know, we've always supported comprehensive immigration reform, but, you know, many times we've had an opportunity for the ag piece to sort of be moved as a pilot. But some people in Congress say, oh, no, we can't do the ag piece because then we won't be able to get back to the rest of this. And so ag has essentially been held hostage. As I mentioned earlier, there are some people who, you know, forget about the details. They'll simply, you know, the folks who want mass deportation of our farm worker population, you know, will call this amnesty and will attack it. And, you know, in a fractious election environment like we're in now, that sends everybody running for the bushes.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. We have one more set here, and so many miles to go with so many things to discuss here. But I'd like to bring up a Michael Olson what if and ask Craig what he thinks of my crazy notion. And that crazy notion is, what would happen if we paid farm workers $50 an hour? Holy smokes, what would happen then? That's my wild and crazy notion, and we'll see what Craig has to say about it when we get back. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. Craig Regelsberger, who is with he's co-chair of Agriculture Coalition for Immigration Reform, right back. Well, something does not quite ring true about cheap labor if we look at the associated costs of using illegal immigrant labor. We see that the costs are actually quite high because we have to feed families, we have to educate them, we have to incarcerate them, and so on, and medicate them, and hospitalize them, and whatnot. And it seems like the real costs of cheap labor make cheap labor actually expensive labor. What would happen if agriculture labor actually was paid a very good, healthy, happy, exorbitant sum, $50 an hour? What would happen then? Well, what would happen, Craig?
Well, we would see the production of our fresh fruits, vegetables, dairy products, meat, milk, go offshore very, very rapidly.
Offshore.
I mean, the reality is farmers don't set prices. Prices are established in a global competitive marketplace. I actually think that the real problem here is not a cheap labor problem, because as a practical matter, the average wage in agriculture is substantially above the federal minimum wage, and there are other sectors of the economy, like food service sector, that actually have a lower average wage than agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, you know, part of it's the nature of the work, which we can, you know, we can't really fundamentally change.
Right.
Part of it is the fact that many farm workers suffer from underemployment. You know, the intermittent nature of the work, the seasonality. You're harvesting the crop now, the harvest ends, and you go through a period of unemployment.
Right.
The big challenge, in my view, is not hourly wages. It's not a cheap labor issue. It's an underemployment issue.
Fair enough. That's a very good observation.
But if I can just add, I mean, the cost. We can make a policy choice that we can import all our food. But if you look at California, as just an example, very labor-intensive agriculture, you've got a $34 billion agricultural industry. It, frankly, is the foundation of the economy.
Yes, out there. Absolutely.
There are 3-to-1 jobs. For every farm worker job at work in California, you've got an estimated 3 jobs in the surrounding economy that exist because farmers are consuming. They're buying equipment. They're buying inputs, you know, packaging. The stevedores at the Port of Oakland.
It's interesting that we moved people off the farm, but not very far, right?
Yeah, but the fundamental reality is that if we do allow our agriculture to offshore by not solving this problem, we've got a lot of American jobs that go to wherever the work is done. This isn't about the farm worker jobs. It's about the upstream, downstream economy jobs. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we can choose to import all our food. I'm not sure we'd feel very secure about that. But we also need to understand the U.S. jobs that are going to go wherever the production goes.
And have been going. Craig Regelsbrugger, let me ask you this. Can we eat without the hands of illegal immigrants to prepare our food?
The only way we can eat without the hands of illegal immigrants is if we get into place a rational and lasting system that doesn't repeat the mistakes that we've repeated over the years. And frankly, it will require an act of Congress.
Maybe even an act of God.
Hopefully Congress.
Okay. Well, Craig, thank you so much for joining us. Craig Regelsbrugger, co-chair, Agriculture Coalition for Immigration Reform. What do you think out there? Do you think we'll find a way to be able to eat without the hands of illegal immigrants? Or are we going to be faced with this situation in which we bring people across the border and to work in the fields so that we can eat food? You can always log on at your comments on the forum at metrofarm.com, and we're glad to see you there. This has been the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, thank you, Craig. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. Bye-bye.
Listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.